more hours than if necessary. The leader of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, cast his ballot early on. Also, senior Iranian officials, including the heads of the three branches of government, cast their votes at the polling stations in the capital, Tehran. Officials have fully and strictly observed health protocols in all polling stations amid the COVID-19 pandemic. There are over 72,000 polling stations across Iran and also some polling stations in other countries for expatriates. Around 3.5 million expatriates, Iranian expatriates, actually are eligible to vote in 234 polling stations set up in various countries. And also, we have reports that many people carrying Iran's flag have queued to vote at schools, mosques, and community centers across Iran. We have reports that followers of other faiths, including Christians, Jews, Zoroastrians, have joined their Muslim brethren in the election. And this is actually a celebration of democracy in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Also, for your information, Iran is simultaneously holding city council and midterm parliamentary and assembly of experts election. Spokesperson of the Constitutional Council has said no irregularities have been reported so far in the election, in Iran's 13th presidential election. Dear listeners, now we go back to the normal course of the IRIB English radio programs, and in the upcoming hours and new sections of IRIB English radio, we get you updated about the latest developments on the 13th presidential election of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Many thanks for being with us.
The debate.
Britain and the European Union have failed to agree on any solutions to ease post-Brexit trade with Northern Ireland and exchange threats in a standoff that could cloud the G7 International Summit over the weekend. Since Britain completed its arduous exit from the EU late last year, its relations with Brussels have sunk, with each side accusing the other of bad faith over a part of their Brexit deal that covers goods movements to Northern Ireland. Britain says that the ball is very much in the EU's court with regards to the implementation of the protocol. The EU says its patience with the UK is running out and threatened trade sanctions if London unilaterally broke its promises. Well, we're now joined by our correspondent, Amina Taylor, who's with us from the British capital, London, with more on that. Amina?
Vadia, it was always going to be this way, wasn't it? Boris Johnson and his team essentially kicked a fundamental aspect of post-Brexit agreements into the long grass. And now I'm afraid those chickens are coming home to roost, because Joe Biden, the U.S. president, is very much a man whose Irish roots have been one of the things that has propped up his rise through U.S. politics. And for so many people in Ireland, they feel that this is a betrayal. They feel this is a complete betrayal of everything that was previously negotiated, and something that London decided that it didn't really like how it looked, so it was going to just drop a new deal after they had agreed with the EU.
All right, thanks a lot, Amina. Taylor joining us from the British capital, London. We're now joined by senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, who's with us from New York. Mr. Williams, welcome to the program. Why have the Tories changed their tune on the Northern Ireland Protocol?
Mostly, I think, because they've only just discovered what it all entails. I mean, the whole Brexit deal was rushed through by Boris Johnson for internal advantage, so he could become the leadership, so he could become the leader of the Conservative Party. So he didn't really care about the details. He hasn't looked at the details. They didn't have contingency plans. So they've really painted themselves into a corner. They had a Northern Ireland agreement, which was the Good Friday Agreement, which binding international agreement, which they've signed on to. And the terms that they've agreed for the to get the Brexit deal rushed through, they just contravene it, straightforward. There's no way he can square the circle to everyone's satisfaction. He can either isolate his allies in amongst the unionists in Northern Ireland by imposing a serious barrier against them, or he's got to reintroduce the Irish border, the Northern Irish Republic of Ireland border again, which contravenes his pledges to the EU and to Joe Biden, it would appear. So, I mean, really, he's painted himself into a corner, and no amount of his usual gymnastics and cavortings can get him out of it. I really cannot see the end results of this, because there's no solution that everyone will find acceptable. He's got a virtual tariff war, so goods going through Northern Ireland on the way to Ireland will have to face a real customs barrier in one way or another, whether it's actually there or not, a virtual customs barrier. They have to pay tariffs, and they have to abide by the laws of the European Union and the treaties. And the utter absurdity of this, which your readers will have missed, I presume, is the sausage war. That, you know, Ireland is big on pork products and sausages, and there's now the issue of whether supermarket sausages made in Britain can be exported to Northern Ireland, because Britain has also pulled out of all the health and safety regulations that the European Union had. And the European Union says, quite rightly, that if you want to import foodstuffs into the European Union, they have to meet our standards. So Boris Johnson has blithely said, no, that's why we left the European Union. We don't want to abide by European standards. And so he's yet another corner to paint himself into. This is a multi-sided room with many corners, and he's painted himself into all of them.
Indeed. Journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas is joining us now on tonight's debate from London. Mr. Abbas, welcome to the program. Boris Johnson, he claims that EU's demands for checks on goods moving between Great Britain and Northern Ireland are too inconvenient and are disrupting trade. Well, they weren't imposed on Britain. It was an agreement that was negotiated. Why does London not want to honor its own handiwork?
Because London didn't think about the consequences of Brexit. The people who were pushing for this exit did it in the most bizarre, most rash manner. Even the actual announcing of the whole process of having a referendum, which seemed needless in the first place, to be fair, it seemed to be something more convenient for the Tory party at that time than the nation itself, was quite a ridiculous notion. And then, of course, the way that it was rushed through, the lack of information, the lies, the downright extra lies, and the outright lies were manifested. I mean, look, they said that Brexit would help the country experience immediate cost savings. Well, that's going to be pretty dubious. I mean, they said that it was because they were paying £13.1 billion in membership dues and et cetera. So, but they didn't mention what they got out of the EU. EU at that time, and most of the public remained ignorant of that. They said Brexit would shift the emphasis of trade for Britain, but again, you see already now that they're moaning and groaning, and their much vaunted exercises in trying to create agreements outside of the EU with the rest of the world aren't going particularly famously. It's an awfully difficult task to renegotiate all these agreements that were rolled into one. And I think, you know, again, this idea of establishing the sovereignty of Britain was very powerful. It was a very emotive and emotional message at the time, on the back of which Boris and his cohort, who were pushing for this exit, premature exit, I would say, actually used the whole British nationalism, or the English nationalism, probably more to the point, because Scotland doesn't seem that keen on this business of Brexit. And we're seeing that Northern Ireland was always going to be the problem, the sting in the tail, if you like, because, of course, it's got the connections with Ireland itself, and that becomes an open door for all sorts of, you know, of course, contradictions, which they're now beginning to uncover. I think the fact that Biden has weighed in and America has weighed in shows where they are pushing the Brits towards. I mean, of course, if they don't go with the Biden scenario, then they're arguably going to suffer with their main card that they were using as a way of sort of balancing the books from the trade they'd lose with the EU, i.e. America, and its vast market where they were supposed to go and push their exports, etc. Well, after what Biden has said, it's quite clear that he's not terribly happy, and America is not terribly happy in giving Britain a carte blanche. So there's been a lot of failures, and I could go on with all the other lies. You know, they said Brexit would reduce the issues with forced immigration associated with the EU. Well, again, another fact that is almost impossible for them to deal with, that Britain can't do without immigrant workers to do the low-end jobs, you know, the fruit pickers, the late-night hotel porters and cleaners, and the people who will do all the jobs which the British public or the British citizenry will leave till the last on their list. So, of course, these are just some of the, if you like, lies and outright sort of foolishness, which right. is now gradually going to get exposed.
Go back to Ian Williams in New York. Ian, the EU's threatening trade sanctions if Johnson unilaterally breaks promises that he made relating to Northern Ireland. If this row escalates any further, are we looking at the possibility of a full-blown trade war, in your opinion?
I think it's very possible. The Europeans, quite understandably, have very little patience for Britain at the moment. They have even less patience for Boris Johnson and his posturings. And, you know, they really see, you know, that they're not being unreasonable. They're asking that they, you know, the agreements as they agreed be actually implemented. You know, it's interesting that one of the reasons why Britain wanted to opt out of European standards is so that they could have a trade deal with America that that encompasses Trump's insistence that they allow polluted, effectively hormone-ridden, bleached American meat products into Britain. That was one of the deals. So he opted out of Europe so they could get that, and now he finds that British sausages, heaven help us, are barred from Northern Ireland. And issue after issue, they just did not think through. They did it on the spur to get a momentary political advantage, to make Boris Johnson the leader of the Conservative Party and the Prime Minister. And over, they didn't think about the implications for the union with Scotland. They didn't think about the implications of the Northern Ireland issue. They didn't think about the implications of the US in the end. Because, you know, Britain still pretends it has a special relationship with the US. But the special relationship is a completely subordinate, servile one. And you know, the US, it finds Britain very useful. It's a sort of diplomatic sepoy who does what the Americans want quite often. But, I mean, the Americans don't need Britain in a serious way, but Britain seriously needs America if it's to maintain its standing in the world. Much vaunted nuclear deterrent is basically borrowed from the Americans. It's on a lease. They're renting it from the Americans. They have to give it back if the Americans don't renew it, or the Americans don't want to. They don't want to help them renew the Trident. So that's Britain's pretensions as a nuclear power. And, I mean, that's what we're all about in many ways. It's about posturing and position, and it's the hanging on by Boris Johnson's fingernails to the illusion that Britain, well, it is a big power, but not a major power. And he's going to fall flat on his face in the mud, or in the Irish Sea at least, at this one.
All right, Sayed Mohsen Abbas, UK's, rather the UK, it says that we can work something out and all is not lost. EU's negotiators, they said the recent talks were not good at all. How do you explain this heavy contrast in tone?
Well, clearly somebody's being dishonest. I rather suspect it's the British, because the EU has been very robust and very straightforward in what it's demanded and wanted. Eventually, they seem to bundle through some kind of agreement over the line. Even that looked very, very dubious at one point. And now we're going backwards yet again. It's sometimes one wonders whoever is constructing this, whether they actually want, from the British policy making side, whether they actually want this chaos to continue. Of course, you've got COVID, you've had the collapse of the economy, which will quietly begin to manifest in real terms for the hardship on people. And on top of that, you've got Brexit, where, you know, the possibility of new jobs, etc., of course, was a big issue that was on the table at the time. You know, there were estimates that 3 million jobs in Britain were connected to trade policies, procedures or activities at that time, and separating from Europe risked and created a risk where these employment opportunities would be lost. And that's exactly still the case, even more so now, given that COVID-19 has affected the economy even more. You know, they said that, of course, Brexit would improve border security. Another nonsense. I mean, there was no real way that you could stop the flow of people and the movement if you're continuing with wars in the Middle East, for instance, as Britain partakes very, very vigorously in across Syria, Afghanistan, and various other places where they've been, of course, triggering the migrant crisis into Europe. So, you know, on the one hand, you're promising that Brexit will improve all this border security, reduce the migrants' population, but yet you're continuing to fuel war for the sake of your, again, economic interests abroad. So, you know, again, there were these kind of paradoxes. And you know, they also talked about how it would, you know, give British bureaucracy freedom, you know, sovereignty and freedom of the bureaucracy. Well, the fact is that the City of London, the Corporation of London here, runs most of our economic trajectory and direction, I would say, behind in the corridors of power. Westminster has almost very little say when it comes to some of these economic realities. And again, I think that if you're going to be saying, oh, we're not going to be controlled by the European technocrats and the bureaucrats, but we're going to do it from Westminster, that's again a kind of fallacy, because Britain is in debt, is getting increasingly more and more in debt. Who's it in debt to? Most of the guys who are down there in the City of London, the corporate banksters and whatever networks they have around them. And it's those folk that actually ultimately underwrite Britain in one shape or form economically. You know, 20 or 30% of the GDP on paper is generated by that square mile in London. So they are a factor which never gets really drawn into these discussions. And they were notably very mute on Brexit. So there are many factors which, prove the lie that Boris and the Tory government pushed through in terms of this fiasco of Brexit.
There are many factors, indeed. Ian Williams, France threatens to veto any changes to the Brexit deal. The French president, Emmanuel Macron, he lambasted the UK for seeking to renegotiate the NI protocol only months after agreeing to it. Macron said nothing is renegotiable and everything should be applied. That's a lot of opposition to the UK's behavior. Unpack Macron's comments for us, please.
It's self-evident. They spent a lot of time negotiating a deal that the British asked for. Remember, the British left. They weren't thrown out. They left despite pleas from people in Europe that they shouldn't. They left. They were offered. They could have taken longer to negotiate and talk around the deals. But they spent 2 years basically spinning wheels and not really doing much in the way of negotiation. Because this is the ineptitude of this. The Conservative Party at least used to pretend to be competent. Competent but callous. I mean, these are incompetent and callous. They didn't factor in all of these details. And we saw that over the COVID as well. I mean, you know, the biggest death rate in the world, or the highest death rate in the world, massive close downs. And it was all because the buffoon in chief was busily pretending that things didn't really happen. He sat there with his hands, you know, like three wise monkeys in one. Do no evil, hear no evil, see no evil. He didn't speak a lot of evil, though. But mostly he was the epitome of callous incompetence. And he still is. And, you know, the real tragedy of Britain is there's no serious opposition to this as well. It's worth mentioning, by the way, that the Labour Party has never organised in Northern Ireland, and actually it's sort of one of its bedrock policies has always been in favour of a united Ireland, with Northern Ireland being separate from Britain. So they're in a bit of a dichotomy here as well. So, you know, the union was a Conservative project. The Conservative Party used to be called the Conservative and Unionist Party. The union with Northern Ireland was their biggest strength. It was one of the reasons they got votes in places like Scotland and in the old days in Liverpool, because they were the Conservative and Unionist Party. And, you know, they've thrown away their historical stuff on this, and they're about to throw away Northern Ireland, it would appear. Scotland, of course, they've managed to alienate almost completely. It's a moot point how long it will last. This is a really tragically disastrous government for Britain, whichever side of the political spectrum you're on. You know, Britain is being dismembered politically, economically, and, you know, diplomatically. And it's a self-inflicted wound.
Mohsen Abbas, the EU has set all Brexit border checks on food, including chilled meats. Entering Northern Ireland from Great Britain would be abolished if the UK signed up to a Swiss-style deal. The UK has already ruled out this option because it requires regulatory alignment with the EU. Now, even if it was temporary, why would Brussels put forth such a solution? The UK didn't go through Brexit just to sign up to EU law again.
Well, I think that they toyed around with the Norwegian model, and now this Swiss model gets talked about. Again, ultimately, what you've got to look at is the incompetence, as my colleague has said, of this establishment, the incompetence actually of the civil service and the background teams that have been advising as well, I would say. I think it seems to be a comedy of errors all the way down the line. And whatever way they try to get out of it, the fact is that you've got a whole list of cons that Brexit was bound to bring in, you know, the elimination of protection of equal pay, maternity leaves and safe workplaces, that's all on the line. You know, all those equal rights for women, the human rights laws, etc. That's also going to be, you know, a lot of it's going to be going down the drain. You know, Brexit, you know, changing the perspective of Britain being the gateway to Europe. You know, how that was one thing which, you know, also was mooted. It was one of the reasons Britain decided to avoid the Eurozone. The strength of its currency was higher, you know. But again, those are delusions, because once your business isn't going well and you've got no investment coming in, your trade is going down, then of course the value of your own currency is going to drop and the economics will start falling all around you. Of course, you know, the labour shortage that I briefly mentioned would kick in, because I know that there are lots of immigrants who from Poland, certainly the East European immigrants, there's been a massive exodus in I think almost some quotes I've had are up to a million plus immigrant workers have already given up on Britain because they just don't see the future here. And these were people who were doing work which was obviously building the economy of Britain, you know. You know, again, also the nonsense around breaking off with such a massive conglomerate of European nations is bound to impact the intelligence the intelligence networks,
sure.
You know, the sharing of information. Which was there on the cards, that's all going to be much, much more difficult to to sort of access, they're not going to be as freely giving in
okay.
that regard and make it weaker as well. Many, many other things I can say that the foreign direct investments in Britain that are being received, they will suffer. The list is endless in terms of the disasters that Brexit is very, very likely to bring in. It hasn't even started yet, I'd say. The Northern Ireland issue is just the tip of the iceberg.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mr. Abbo. Sorry to jump in there. We're fresh out of time for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsen Abbas, joining us from London. Also, thanks to senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, Mr. Ian Williams, speaking to us from New York. Also, special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint. A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program, and my dear guest, Sayyid Abdullah, and Brother Hussein. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid Abdullah, and
welcome
to the program. Wa alaikum
assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having us.
Welcome. Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam, happy to be here.
Welcome. Well, let's focus on the movie in this episode, the movie called God Send. It was released in 2004, directed by Nick Hamm. All right? In this movie, a couple lose their young son in a car accident, right? They are approached by a fertilizing doctor, who happens to be Robert De Niro in the movie, of course. Mm-hmm. Who claims to be able to clone their son only on condition that, they start over their life and live elsewhere, not in the same town. The clone, though, when they agreed, so the clone proves to be identical to the deceased boy. But when he reaches his 8th birthday, things begin to go wrong very horribly. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm not going to like spoil the whole thing for those people who didn't watch the movie. Of course, it's an old movie, fairly old movie. Mm-hmm. So for those people who want to watch it, they better do. I'm not going to like kill their joy. So let me start with you, Sayyid Abdullah. How do you like the movie?
I don't know if I liked it to begin with. It was, because I don't know, sometimes like maybe I'm a little bit, I don't know, maybe it's just me. When I watch a movie, I'd like to make a sense of the movie, right? Mm. Like, you know, when events happen, you attach things to one another, and like you would have one genre happening, and then, you know, you get into the movie itself.
Yes.
But the movie began okay, mm-hmm. right? So a child dies, and then the doctor trying to clone the kid, and everything seems to be fine.
Yes.
And then it turned, you know, from a just a normal cloning movie into a horror movie.
Yes.
Which, you know, I did not get. And then the father has to do his own search to find out why his son having nightmares or all these things, which to the kid were real because he can see them on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
So I think like half of the movie was okay. The other half was just all over the place. And then just, I think they killed it. They just did not continue. They should have just continued the cloning process. And they would have given it a different ending rather mm-hmm. than the one they had. Maybe it would have been a lot better. And I'm saying this from the fact that it is The budget was 25 mil.
Yes.
That made 30 mil.
30 million. Yeah.
So it, even the box office did not make it. And it, we're talking about back in the day, right, where people like actually used to watch a lot of movies.
Exactly.
And it did not make it.
It wasn't the because time of COVID-19 or exactly something like that. They used to go to the movies.
Yeah,
like
I used to go to the movies all the time. And yeah, then, like, you know, people were, it was just like a joyous thing that we used to do. So yes, when, especially Robert De Niro, right, a big name in Hollywood. When he brings a movie, I don't care what kind of a movie it is. If he's in it, I'm going to watch it, right?
Yeah, but I know that's your movie, but
but you know, the story itself just did not make it for me. I don't know. I was disappointed in Robert De Niro, to say the least.
Okay, let's take a break, and we'll be back.
My clinic has perfected a procedure by which a single cell could be used to create a genetically identical fetus. A fetus which could be carried to term and, in effect, be reborn.
Do you mean cloned?
Yes. Yes, yes.
This would be the identical boy down to the last chromosome on the last hair of his head.
So you want to help us?
I used to be affiliated with a hospital here, and I had a chance to review Jesse's records.
You did what?
I'm aware of the complications surrounding Adam's delivery. That it's impossible for you to conceive again.
You looked at her records.
I had to be certain that Jesse's condition didn't preclude carrying a child, and it doesn't. So, yes, I can help you. You can have him back.
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique on RIB English Radio. Well, we're talking about God Sent, the movie released in 2004, this horror, thriller, or drama, basically, Brother Hussein. How did you like the movie? Did you find it attractive or something interesting to watch?
Actually, I'd say it was the opposite of attractive. I feel like this film is more of a like cinema movie, especially back in the day when they released it. It was more of a movie that you'd watch, you know, on a weekday night or something like that. But in general, I feel like it was a drama-driven movie.
Mm-hmm.
It had a lot of, you know, action scenes, I guess. Lots of heartfelt moments. And the thing is about this movie that it, you know, like Brother Abdullah said, it didn't really flow very well. The beginning was kind of normal, but then it kind of turns dark. And, you know, with the nightmares of the kid and, you know, all the other stuff that happens, I didn't really...
You know, when we were talking about, like, in the earlier episodes, talking about the movie The Sixth Day, you, in fact, found out that this seemed to be a kind of mismatch between reality and the movie, or what concept the movie was trying to push.
Yeah.
All right? What about this movie? Do you think that, they depicted the reality of cloning, which is the subject of our discussion, too?
So, not really sure what to say. Of course, each writer has his own predictions about the future of technology like this. So, I feel like this was also a unique perspective. And like I did say in the previous episode, it's either a hit or a miss, but... Only time will tell.
Mm-hmm. You know, we have in 1996 or 7, we have the phenomenon of Dolly the Sheep, all right? And then there is a claim in around 2000, if I'm not mistaken, in South Korea of talking about cloning a human being, all right, for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But it proved to be wrong. They didn't show any evidence. Nor did they do the same thing in 2004, which is concurrent with the time of release of this movie. Mm-hmm. 2004, again, there was another rumor in South Korea at one of the universities that they basically cloned a human being. But again, there was no scientific evidence whatsoever released to the media or to... the critics and skeptics of the time.
It was two articles were written by two different scientists, like you mentioned, and I think Science, the organization, they withdrew these two articles because they said there's absolutely no proof of it. And it's, that, as the process itself
exactly.
is complicated, they said they just...
Even with Dolly the Sheep, 276 attempts failed.
Exactly, yeah.
And then 277th attempt succeeded and led to the Dolly, which lived a few years after.
Six months.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah.
All right. So do you think, Brother Hussein, there is a kind of, what do you call it, a coincidence?
With what exactly?
With the time?
I feel like, especially with university students or, you know, young people, they sort of, you know, are hyped up by these movies or by these events, and they try to, you know, sometimes even lie about stuff like this happening. Like you said, there was no evidence found with these people, with their claims. So it was dismissed.
I see. Yeah. Okay, let's take a break and we'll be back.
Of one original cell. Now, key to artificially stimulating replication is in shocking a specialized cell back to its pre-specialized state, its stem cell precursor, the cell as it was before it became a liver cell or a brain cell or a relatively simpler cheek cell. Once in this state, the cell's nucleus is immediately transferred to a mother's enucleated egg. The transfer completed, the egg cell will then ideally accept the donor nucleus as its own, at which point we let nature take its course.
Back to the program Viewpoint on Arabi English Radio. We are talking about the critique of the movie Godsend, a 2004 drama movie. The most important or famous star in the movie is Robert De Niro. Sayyid Abdullah, there are things, in fact, like portrayed in this movie related to the idea of cloning. Like when this son, the clone, reaches the eighth birthday, he starts having like nightmares or something like that, or visions. It came to be even... in reality, like happening in reality. Do you think that those like nightmares could exist, like for real? Clones?
Okay, so first we have to come to the agreement that we already had successfully cloned a human being.
Yes.
Then we come to your question. I think from the question that you asked the Brother Hussein before, where the, you know, the cloning process was better, at least it done a lot well than the sixth day, right? Because it went through the pre-productive cloning system where they take the embryo and they plant it in a womb and then you have a child, which is scientifically, that's what they're hoping to achieve. Like you said, with Dolly, it took 100-something attempts.
Yes.
With a human being, it might take, I don't know, more than that. But they might need like different, I don't know, maybe a couple of hundred wombs for it to work. But this is just pre-productive system, so it's done a lot better in the cloning process than the sixth day, right?
Yes.
So this could be digested, could be swallowed, because it could be scientifically later on could work.
Yeah.
But that itself, it's not going to give you a clone. It's going to give you an identical twin, right? So we call it a twin.
Yes.
So it's going to give you a human being that looks like the old one, the predecessor, but he would have his own personality. He would have his own soul. He would not be the same exact person. The outside might be, but not the inside. In this movie, though, they were assuming that up to 8 years, he was identical from outside and inside. So he was doing very well. Once he hits eight, because the child dies at eight, and even Robert De Niro in the movies, we don't know what's going to happen up to eight.
Yes, after that.
after, because he it's a plane.
Mm-hmm.
So then that thing, you know, he started having his own imaginary things.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're trying to say is that the personality of the other child, we tried to conflict with the child himself, where in fact what Rob Junior did, he inserted his own son's genes,
yes,
in that child.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it's very complicated in a sense, like if we need to, you know, dissect the movie itself, because we don't even have, not only do we have a clone,
mm-hmm,
as a body, but we have two personalities in that clone.
Yes.
We have De Niro's son and we have that child himself.
Right.
And then that De Niro's son, his personality is trying to take over the body itself and be the active host.
Yes.
Which, that's where you have the whole horror theme to it.
No.
So,
you know, is it logically possible for, like, somebody to experience the same, like, mentalities, the same feelings and emotions?
Well, if we're talking scientifically, look, yeah, scientifically.
Or logically,
right?
Not even
no,
scientifically.
Not,
when
the,
you
leave
think
logic, leave logic aside, because sometimes logic cannot process things, right?
Uh-huh,
cannot fathom.
Okay.
Scientifically, they've proven, like, I don't know, years back, that some traits get transferred through DNA. So, for example, some of my father's traits get transferred to me. For example, if my father was generous, that trait of generosity I could carry that. That would it transferred to my gene.
Generosity
so
is different from like the same type of like happening or experience.
No, so let me
another real life.
So this is what I'm trying to get.
Externally,
this is what I'm trying to get. So if we're saying scientifically it's possible,
mm-hmm,
for certain traits to be transferred, there's also a possibility that you might have memories or feelings that a person had,
mm-hmm,
could be transferred to you. So scientifically, maybe in the future they could prove that, because the DNA itself is a very complex thing, right?
True.
It could carry many things.
Yes.
We haven't, like, we just recently we managed to break the DNA code, right? We don't know what's in the code itself.
Yes.
So maybe the code itself, it could not only carry the trace, but it could carry memories with it,
mm-hmm,
that you might experience yourself. So you could have a dream, you could have a vision of something that already been seen in the past. It's
yes,
possible, like scientifically possible.
I have
ethically, I don't see why not.
Yeah,
but
have
would
some
it take over you? I doubt.
Yeah, I have some serious issues with that.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the time of this episode has come to an end. Let me put it off to the next upcoming episode.
Inshallah.
Thank you very much for listening to the program Viewpoint on RIB English Radio. We were talking about Godsend. And we covered some issues, but hopefully we're going to continue this episode into the next one. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Push back, constrain, and engage. These are the core elements contained in a European Commission policy proposal which has just been presented relating to Russia. The 27-country bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, says the EU must be realistic
and prepare for a further downturn of our relations with Russia, which are right now at the lowest level. And this further downturn is the most likely outlook for the time being.
The new policy proposal suggests the EU must push back against Russia's human rights violations and international law breaches. This mostly relates to Ukraine and Georgia. The EU must constrain attempts by Moscow to undermine EU interests. Here the document talks about cyber attacks. But the bloc should engage with Russia on COVID-19, climate change, travel visas, and efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal. Big claims require big evidence, and the EU has never come forward with a shred of evidence, the Kremlin insists. There are many experts who believe the EU is going down the wrong path.
The West has an interest, an institutional self-interest,
in aggravating the crisis with Russia, a crisis which need never have started in the first place, but which was aggravated by the way the West supported the most radical elements in Ukraine.
Borrell was asked about the EU's dependency on Russia's energy. He responded, "There is no mention of this subject at all in the policy document." The Commission proposal contains a provision for additional sanctions on Russia, but EU leaders are divided over the effectiveness of such measures. They will make their final decisions on the matter during a summit here at the European Council next week. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After two perilous days and a difficult night, 69-year-old activist Nicholas Georges has returned to ground level after mounting a huge crane overlooking the US Embassy in London. Armed with little more than a Palestinian flag, Georges risked his life in the daredevil stunt to raise awareness of Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
Every day, day in, day out, demolishing more and more Palestinian homes. The Palestinians have no rights. Even their electricity and their water is taken from them. Israel is the fourth largest military power, nuclear military power in the world. The Palestinians have nothing.
Apart from the obvious risk of falling to his death, the two-day ordeal has been very challenging in other ways too, as explained by fellow activists supporting him from the ground.
Apart from the climb itself, which was huge, he has suffered from the cold at night because he couldn't fit a sleeping bag onto his backpack. So he spent last night very cold, and he sent a few messages saying, "I'm really, really cold." Luckily, because he's so high up, the crane actually caught the first morning sun. So he was the first person to actually warm up. But now he's suffering from the heat, because obviously there's no shade. One, two,
three, as supporters cheered Mr. George's successful landing, he was unable to speak directly to us, as any media talks after this action could affect his possible court battle to come.
So there you have it. Nick is back down safe and sound. But the battle will not end here. After a visit to hospital, Nick will likely be brought in for questioning by the police and potentially even charged for some of the conduct over the past couple of days. Then could come a lengthy court battle which Nick will have to fight against as well. But the lessons that can be taken from this is that the activists behind these brave actions know the consequences, but they still do it anyway, meaning that until there is a solution for the oppressed Palestinian people, this type of action will continue to occur, not just in the UK, but worldwide, possibly as well. Robert Carter, London.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held demonstrations in several parts of the enclave in response to the return of the controversial flag march in East Jerusalem al-Quds. The protesters say the move is aimed at provoking Palestinians' anger. They burnt Israeli flags and vowed to defend Jerusalem al-Quds with all means.
The Israeli regime is responsible for the consequences of its crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. It's provoking us by holding this flag march. Palestinian resistance in all parts of Palestine announces its readiness to respond to the violations in Al-Aqsa Mosque. The international community should stop such violations.
The extremist flag march passed through the old city's Damascus Gate and entered the Muslim Quarter. This amid a fragile ceasefire in the Gaza Strip following the recent Israeli aggression that claimed nearly 250 Palestinian lives. The flag march caused Hamas to warn that the tensions in the Gaza Strip will break out again after Israel's 11-day escalation on the enclave.
Our Palestinian people are all united in defending Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Our message is clear that we will not allow Israel to impose its plans of stealing our land and holy places. We will sacrifice everything for Palestine, and the resistance is ready to fight back. We do not trust any Israeli ceasefire, and we are committed to it as long as Israel keeps it.
Palestinian resistance in Gaza announced its readiness for any conflict against the Israeli regime in response to the violations against Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds.
Any Palestinian would feel angry for what is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds and the Israeli violations of our rights. We are all united in facing this occupation. We are supporting the resistance and we are proud of its achievements in defending us. We will not give up al-Quds and our holy places, and the Israeli plans there will fail because we are the true owners of the land.
The controversial flag march in Jerusalem al-Quds risks reigniting tensions with Palestinians, both in the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip. Hamas has warned that the march will trigger a new conflict for defending al-Quds and al-Aqsa Mosque. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The U.S. State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs said the U.S. envoy to Yemen has met with the director of USAID to discuss the need for more donors to provide additional humanitarian funding to address the growing crisis in Marib. Experts believe that this step is an attempt by the U.S. to provide new weapons to its tools in Marib, including terrorist groups who protect its agenda in the oil-rich province.
The continued advancement of the Yemeni army toward liberating Marib prompted the United States to use the humanitarian crisis to supply the terrorist groups in Marib with weapons so that the conflict could not be prolonged. U.S. push for peace has no basis in reality, and continued siege on the Yemeni people is the proof.
Observers said the USAID plays a suspicious role wherever it exists, adding that it uses the humanitarian and relief work as a cover-up for its military and intelligence activities.
The U.S. Agency for International Development is an intelligence agency. It shows the humanitarian aspect, but it hides a lot of illegal activities, including supporting terrorist groups with weapons. The United States will not accept peace unless its conditions are met. Washington is the one who leads the war in Yemen and cannot be a peacemaker.
Last year, the Yemeni army found large quantities of weapons carrying the logo of USAID in Al-Bayda and Marib front lines after recapturing areas that were controlled by Daesh and Al-Qaeda. Yemenis believe that the U.S. is directly involved in the deadly war against their country. They say it is their right to liberate their lands from any foreign existence, as well as terrorist groups who serve the interests of the U.S. and Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. troops are fast withdrawing from Afghanistan under a peace deal American had with the Taliban 2 years ago. On the other hand, the Taliban, the militant group who already control nearly 75% territory, is now sieging and capturing districts and regions around the capital city. The Afghan government blames neighboring Pakistan for supporting Taliban's ongoing rapid territorial gains, an allegation Pakistan denies. With the new law in the bilateral ties between Afghanistan and Pakistan, influential former diplomats, think tanks, and politicians from the both sides held a meeting in Islamabad. The objective behind this gathering, better known as Track 2 diplomacy, is to bring down the tension between two countries and help Kabul to find out a peaceful solution. Negotiations between the Taliban and Ashraf Ghani government have resumed in Doha with no progress in sight. The Taliban wants setting up their brand of an Islamic government, while Ashraf Ghani is not willing to accept an interim setup to replace him. The U.S. fears the Taliban could possibly overrun the capital Kabul if President Ashraf Ghani does not strike a peace deal with them.
And the withdrawal obviously will take place, with or without the settlement. God forbid we are sucked back into the 90s, and there is anarchy. Civil war. Is that a concern? Yes, it is.
The U.S. has made it clear that Pentagon would not carry out airstrikes from its aircraft carriers outside Afghanistan to prevent Taliban's possible takeover of capital Kabul.
The Americans are tired of this war. They are fatigued, and they want to leave as soon as possible. And they don't want to invest more money, more energy, and they don't want to fight in Afghanistan any longer. Taliban are very confident they will be able to establish, their upper hand in any future dispensation.
In a recent interview with a German newspaper, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said he knows his death is just one bullet away. Analysts believe that his remarks shows on how he perceives the threat of Taliban's violent takeover of capital Kabul after the U.S. lost war and left his government on to the mercy of warring Taliban. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Based on official statistics, systematic targeting of Shia people in Afghanistan kicked off almost 7 years ago. Since then, over 1,000 Shia civilians have been killed and many others wounded, including women and children, in tens of separate attacks, such as bomb blasts or targeted killings.
Our people face a real systematic genocide, and this trend has drawn a very dark future for us. We have been repeatedly targeted by brutal terrorist attacks, mainly in western Kabul. I think gone are those days when people were killed because of their belief or ethnicity.
However, it seems that the time for killing of Shia people has already arrived for the terrorist groups, mainly Daesh.
This comes as the Afghan presidential palace has promised to implement a comprehensive security plan in western Kabul to tackle security threats there. However, there is still no positive change in the security situation in the Shia-dominated area of western Kabul.
In the latest incident on Saturday evening, two minivans were blown up in western Kabul. The twin blasts claimed the lives of at least 7 Shia civilians and wounded more than 10 others. In the meantime, some prominent Shia leaders urged the government to either urgently unveil its own security plan for western Kabul or approve People's Security Plan to protect Shia people against terrorist attacks and bombings.
The government must provide our people with security, otherwise the situation will get more dangerous. This will force peaceful people to pick up guns once again to protect themselves against violence.
Afghan government blames Taliban for targeting Shia population. Taliban, however, reject the accusation. This comes as Daesh proudly claims responsibility for most of such attacks and even warn of launching more and more attacks on Shia people across the country. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
On the sidelines of the NATO summit in Brussels, Democrats Abroad Belgium held a rally to coincide with the visit of Joe Biden. We sought their views on current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal, which Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, tried to destroy.
I would actually encourage Biden to make that leap of faith and go ahead and say, listen, we're in, the sanctions are lifted, now it's up to you.
I don't know any more about the outcome than you do, but I'm confident that they're sincere about trying.
I'm crossing my fingers. He's allowed to do at least half of what he's trying to do because there's a lot of obstruction in the Senate, of course.
Inside the summit, calls were made for the 30 countries in NATO to stand strongly together in order to face down current threats.
Especially at a time when authoritarian regimes like Russia and China challenge the rules-based international order.
Moscow and Beijing reject the criticism, and some analysts argue NATO is merely trying to justify its existence by creating adversaries. Also, there are divisions within NATO itself. For example, Turkey and Germany have important economic ties to Russia and China. Even the UK seems to be trying to tone down NATO HQ rhetoric.
I don't think anybody around the table today wants to descend into a new Cold War with China. I don't think that's where people are, but I think people see, they see challenges.
For his part, Joe Biden had this to say about Vladimir Putin ahead of a meeting with the Russian president on Wednesday.
He's bright, he's tough, and I have found that he is as they say, when he used to play ball, a worthy adversary.
There have not been huge protests to coincide with Biden's visit to Belgium. That's in stark contrast to when Donald Trump was here. Clearly, the optics are different on this occasion, but critics of U.S. foreign policy say fundamentally the same problems still exist. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After more than a decade, Israel has turned the page of Benjamin Netanyahu rule, ushering in a new era with a new coalition cabinet led by Naftali Bennett, the head of the right-wing Yamina party, and Yair Lapid, the leader of Yesh Atid party. However, the Palestinian leadership remains skeptical, saying it expects no changes in Israeli policy towards Palestinians. It says the only difference that could be seen is that former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will no longer be there. Palestinian officials say they expect the Bennett-Lapid cabinet to be worse than the one it's replacing.
Israel's policy